This is the Takeaway Weekender. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And just imagine spending hours in the breathtaking beauty of Tanzania in Africa, just looking at monkeys, primates, or chimpanzees. Jane Goodall's work as an experienced naturalist for more than 50 years, sitting and watching and taking careful notes about how chimps behave, resulted in numerous scientific breakthroughs, among them the confirmation of tool use on the part of primates, as well as the discovery of all sorts of complex social structures and sophisticated parenting skills and interactions. Now, it may not be very anthropologically valid to say, but I know that if I was part of a rough-and-tumble band of wild chimps, I would like nothing better than to have this gentle, soft-spoken, clear-eyed, persistent lover of Africa to spy on me for years. How could you not become a friend? Well, we had less time than that to get to know Jane Goodall when she popped into our studio this past week. But even in the short minute she was here in our studio, she quieted our rough and tumble gang right down. Call this a conversation with Jane Goodall, the director's cut.
I saved up money to go to Africa because I wanted to live with wild animals and write books about them. And happened to meet the late Dr. Louis Leakey. And it was he who suggested I go and study chimpanzees in Tanzania.
And you are descended from, if we're to get anthropological about this, a writer and a car enthusiast, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Well, my father did race motor cars, but in the days when it was fun rather than the kind of competitive thing it is now. And my mother, well, she wrote two books, but I don't think she would describe herself as a writer.
You know, science in the days that you were growing up is so focused on structure, individual structure of fossils, what's inside a fossil, what's inside an anatomical structure. But your notion of science and the gathering of data was very, very different. Describe how you viewed what you would observe as a scientist that would be different from what the very traditional, and many of them were very British, anthropologists and doctors would observe to discover the structure of life.
Well, you see, the way it happened, I didn't want to be a scientist. I didn't go out into the field to be a scientist. Louis Leakey wanted me to learn about chimpanzees because he was interested in, our earliest Stone Age ancestors, and he thought that learning something about our closest relative in the wild might help him to understand it. I hadn't been to college when I went out into the field, and so I had no preconceived notions about anything. And I learned about animals and that, of course, they do have personalities and minds and feelings. I learned about that as a child from my dog. So I simply went into the field to learn about chimpanzees by getting into their, not being part of their social life, but getting them to accept me without fear so that I could sit and observe and write down. And when I started, I just had a pen, a notebook, and some not very good binoculars. That was all the tools I had. And so gradually the chimpanzees revealed their personalities, their behavior. I saw tool using, I saw tool making, learned what the various postures and gestures meant and the calls, and then get to Cambridge and I'm told I've done it all wrong because Louis Leakey said I had to get a PhD. There was no time for a BA, but luckily remembered the training I had from my dog.
And which is more important, the training as a PhD or the training you got from your dog to look at the humanistic characteristics of an animal?
It was the lessons I learned from my dog and I suppose the rest of my childhood loving animals that enabled me to go into the field and observe the way I did. When I got to Cambridge, what I learned there was also really important. It was how to organize the data I'd collected and put that into a form that was accessible to other scientists, which I think gradually changed the way science regarded animals. I think it really did help, just because chimps are so like us. But, you know, the other part of what I always wanted to do was write books, and I did that. And when I wrote the books, I could really write about the chimpanzees the way, well, the way they are.
Why was it such a controversial notion that someone who would take a very anthropomorphic idea of a dog into the wild to observe chimpanzees, why was that perceived as so controversial and a sign of a lack of education when over time you discovered that it in fact was the key to educating yourself about this community?
Well, when I began science, and I suppose religion, and therefore many, many people, believed that there was a difference in kind between us and the rest of the animals. In fact, it's a difference of degree. And the chimps helped to blur what was seen as a sharp line just because, you know, biologically we share 98% of our DNA with them. And the structure of blood and immune system and brain is almost identical. So it was a easy way then to sort of say, well, as they're so like us biologically, doesn't it make sense that if their brain is structured so like ours, that they probably are capable of thinking? And when you see the tool using, the tool making, it becomes pretty obvious. So the chimps were the obvious way to help break down that barrier.
You, of course, had no fear of chimps when you started in 1960, I believe, of setting up your camp and trying to observe them. They wanted very little to do with you, though, it seems.
Yeah, they were scared. They're very conservative. They ran away. Quite wise of them, really.
Yeah. Do you think that was based on experience of humans hunting in the jungle, so an acquired experience, or just something that they...
No, just where I was, you know, there wasn't any hunting of them, luckily.
So how do you think their losing fear of you changed them?
I don't think it changed them at all, except, I mean, what it did was when I approached, they would look up at me and just carry on with what they were doing. If I had tried to work my way into their society, like Diane Fossey did with the gorillas, then I think it would change behavior. But my goal was always to be a peeping Tom, if you like, to watch. And you couldn't do it without being seen by them. Therefore, you have to get them used to you.
Two questions. One, a little controversial, and then the other, I think you've probably been asked many times before. Why was Diane Fossey wrong?
Well, Diane Fossey, it wasn't so much that she was wrong, but what I tried to persuade her to change was her attitude to the local people. Because from the very beginning, I involved as many of the local people as possible to help in the field. And she would not let the local people have anything to do with the gorillas, never to see them. She said that would make them more vulnerable to poaching. And I said, Diane, I know you're wrong because our chimps, you know, they know the people we employ, but if they meet a strange African, they run away. And the gorillas are going to be just the same. And so she built up this resentment with the poachers.
Who will you, of this community that you've grown to know and love, who will you most worry about after you're gone?
You mean the chimpanzees?
The chimpanzees, the characters and communities and families that you've grown to know so intimately.
Well, all the ones I knew really intimately, unfortunately, they've all gone. So it's their descendants. And I wouldn't worry about one of those families more than another. They're all special. They all have their own, you know, individual characters and life stories and sort of all in it together. But the only way that we can protect them, and this now is so entrenched as part of the Jane Goodall Institute, that it will go on after I've gone, for sure, if we can build up our endowment. And so that's, unless we improve the lives of the people living around wilderness areas, then we'll never save those areas. It's only by making the local people partners, by finding alternative ways for them to live than cutting down and selling trees or killing and selling animals, etc. So we've been extremely successful in this all around Gombe National Park and way down south. Trees that were gone are coming back again. And we've replicated that in 5 other countries around chimp habitat.
Have you ever convinced anyone who is making their living off of poaching that they needed to find another way?
Well, there was a little poaching going on around Gombe, and for the most part, because we've got people, I think probably the most important program we introduced was microcredit, based on Mohamed Yunus's Grameen Bank, mostly for groups of women choosing their own environmentally sustainable project, small, and then things like buying some chickens or buying a field they can grow pineapples in. The coffee grows excellent coffee around there. And so, you know, gradually the people are improving their lives. Their children are, well, we're trying to improve the education. Our youth program is in all the villages. And so the only hunting that is, we have some refugees from Congo, and they live by hunting. So it's been a bit difficult trying to cope with them.
Here's a wild one. What if you were some resident of a place, you know, from another galaxy, and you arrived here on Earth? The stories that you tell about the chimpanzees are such happy, meaningful stories about a community of animals that has so much to teach us humans. If you were, instead of looking at the chimpanzees and monkeys, were in fact looking at the humans for all this time and trying to get to know them and sort of patiently peering into their communities and behaviors, what do you think the story would be that you would tell of of the humans? Would it be a happy one or would it be a tragic one?
I think it would depend which part of humanity you were actually watching. If you were watching all of it overall, I think you would throw up your hands in horror and say, how is it possible that the most intellectual creature to ever walk on the planet is destroying its only home? And don't they realize that if they go on multiplying like this, they'll run out of natural resources, which are finite? But, you know, the sad thing is that chimpanzees are capable of violence and brutality too. And the longer we watch them, the more we find that in some families you have the dark side of human nature there as well. So we're much more like them than we ever used to think.
Jane Goodall's face and character are so recognizable that she is a natural for the Disney Nature Ambassador Program. Disney helps support Jane Goodall's research while Goodall appears in films for kids on animals and their disappearing habitats. Her newest film, Monkey Kingdom, is the story of Maya, a low-ranking macaque being bullied by some higher-ranking females who are making life miserable for Maya, and especially for Maya's son, Kip.
Welcome to the world, Kip. Maya is consumed by unconditional love. She is lost in her infant.
That's Tina Fey, narrator of Monkey Kingdom, which is in theaters this Friday. Goodall says that the temptation to make animals into little Disney characters can never overwhelm the truth that animals must always be understood on their own terms.
The actual filming is authentic. The commentary, everybody knows animals don't speak. So far as I'm concerned, it just makes the film more appealing to kids. And I have no criticism of that at all. I think these Disney nature films are great.
What do you think they thought of you?
The big advantage was that those monkeys in the film had already been studied by a scientist for 40 years. And so when the team arrived, they were able to kind of piggyback on that and find out where were the monkeys who were most used to people, the easiest to find, who did have interactions with the cities outside, and a picturesque place. So they found all those things. But then what was so amazing is they wanted to show the tough life of a low-ranking female, which is because there's a caste system.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they picked a monkey who was easily identifiable with marks on her nose and beautiful haircut. And how could they possibly have predicted that a whole story would grow out of that over the 3 years it took them to make the film? It was magical.
Were you wary of these filmmakers trying to impose a narrative when there was none there?
No, they didn't impose anything. I know this team well. They worked on Chimpanzee and Bears for Disney Nature as well. They're just wonderful people. And being there 3 years, they get to know the individuals. They know their personalities. They know exactly what to film that will demonstrate the personalities they've come to know and the subtle interactions between the different individuals in the troupe.
Mm. What's the difference between a macaque and a chimp and all these various terms?
Chimpanzees, gorillas, orangutans are the great apes.
Right.
We are a great ape too. Biologically, we are apes.
Glad to hear that.
The macaques are monkeys. So you get macaques and baboons. They're all old world. And then you get all the other monkeys.
And this story... in this latest film, is about a macaque. Right?
Yes, a troop of toque macaques, toque being the hairstyle,
right.
In Sri Lanka, which I love because I've never been to Sri Lanka before. And with the setting on this 1,000-year-old ruins of an old kingdom where the monkeys have made their home on a temple, it was just lovely.
Now, were you rooting for Maya in this film?
Oh, absolutely.
Totally. So no objectivity, throw that right out the window.
Throw it out of the window. I mean, Maya, hopefully everybody watching will empathize with Maya as she tries to struggle out of this horrible low-ranking position where the three, I call them the ugly sisters, they call it the sisterhood, these three top-ranking females. They look ugly. They've got red faces, and they're so mean to the low-ranking females, taking their babies away to play with. And the mother doesn't dare get the baby back. Well, she does in the end, but they're really... But then you see things like, imagine monkeys swimming underwater, filmed underwater, looking like otters. And they also climb up into the tree, the younger ones, about 20 foot up, and jump down. And then big splash, climb up, jump down again. They're just having fun, like a bunch of kids.
Having fun, but also unwilling, at least in Maya's case, to accept defeat, to accept no one could say no to her.
No, well, Maya was really lucky because what happened is a handsome young male, Kumar, came in from another troop, which is, you know, then the alpha male of Maya's troop is going to drive him out. But before that happens, he has a little secret liaison with Maya, which gets her pregnant. Then he's driven out. Maya remains low-ranking. But then Kumar comes back and forms alliances and drives out the top-ranking male and gets to a high position in the hierarchy. And that automatically means that he will support Maya and she can move up, which is rare. So this just happened in the film.
A scandal worthy of the royals.
Absolutely.
Yes.
But wonderful.
Yes.
I mean, you know, the whole thing, and it's so picturesque with the ruins and the interactions with other animals, playing with the village dogs, a lot of village dogs around the place because it's a Buddhist society. So monkeys and dogs are not persecuted. And then interact with people. They go and raid a birthday party. And the kids watching this movie will love that scene.
There's something classic about these stories, about your stories, about the finding of the patience to find a community of monkeys. What do you think it says to the rest of humanity, your work?
Well, I think, you know, if you don't have the patience and you don't have the passion, you'll never do the kind of work that I and others do. And so because we have that, gifts, if you like, we can then share with other people, and hopefully people will leave this film feeling this. Of course animals have personalities and minds and feelings, and of course we should treat them with more respect, and of course we should understand we're part of the animal kingdom and not separated from them.
Jane Goodall, thank you so much for this time. It's been just an absolute delight talking to you.
Oh, thank you very much.
Jane Goodall, the founder of the Jane Goodall Institute, which aims to research and protect chimpanzees and their habitats, can be seen in Our Habitat. There are pictures of her and me and our staff on the website. She's also United Nations and Disney Nature Ambassador. Thanks for listening to this edition of the Takeaway Weekender. We'll see you on Monday with some exciting stuff. including a live performance with Tennessee musician Drew Holcomb and much more. Until then, check everything out at thetakeaway.org. And of course, have a great weekend.
This has been the Takeaway Weekender podcast. You can catch all our show's content by visiting us at thetakeaway.org. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/thetakeaway and follow us on Twitter using the handle @thetakeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.